Hello, and welcome to this week's Shoot the Moon podcast here at Revenue Rocket as we move into the 4th of July holiday. We are today going to talk a little bit about the impacts of the SBA on the M&A landscape and loans, as well as forecasting your business and kind of post-COVID world and a variety of other topics. We're going to introduce, again, Ryan Barnett, super valuable partner here at the firm. And we're going to have a dialogue like we have in the last few podcasts. Ryan, take it away.
Hey, Mike. Well, thanks for having me on. And kind of an interesting week. We got PPP loans that are coming to a close. We saw some new employment numbers that make a lot of questions on where the future of this thing's going. We saw some closings and increases in cases. So all I can say is we're walking into a week of uncertainty, and perhaps we can make a little bit of sense of it. But really wanted to, since we're in the middle of deals now, then, and this topic has come up, I had some questions about some SBA loans, some EIDL loans, and PPP loans that are out there, and wanted to get a little bit of your perspective. I'd love to just start out, you know, what do you think the current state of the SBA is now? I'd imagine that banks are a bit of overwhelmed about other things. What do you think is happening in the M&A world when a buyer wants to raise a bit of funds using some traditional lending methods?
Yeah. So in general, I think the SBA has responded pretty well, at least in the IT services world, to the COVID crisis. They've leaned in, you know, with the stimulus packages, the PPP loans, and the EIDL loans, the EIDL loans, as we call them. They have certainly responded with some interesting programs. For those of you, you know, this week, I guess technically on the 30th of June, the PPP loan program did close down in taking new applications. There is a move by some in the government to reinstate the program because there was upwards of $130 billion that was not used in the PPP allocation. And I think, you know, that'll probably pass, some form of that will pass to allow those monies to be available, to folks that either didn't know they were available or didn't apply for them. But there was, you know, over 4 million approved PPP loans. I think upwards of 4.8 million PPP loans that were approved and monies were sent out. And so as a result, there's plenty of firms in our ecosystem and IT services that have them on their balance sheet. And I think, you know, it'll be important because of the change of control provisions as well as other provisions in all SBA loans, not just PPP and EIDL loans, that, you know, you get the appropriate permissions from your bank or the SBA in preparation for a transaction if you're contemplating a sale. It would be, I guess, our recommendation that if you're contemplating a sale that you already go through your PPP loan forgiveness exercise. It seems that that process has been extended now to the end of 2020, and we currently do not have guidance from the SBA on how even to do that. So as of, you know, today, which is the 2nd of July 2020, we don't know, you know, what those forgiveness rules are going to be. We think that they're going to be released soon. The SBA is committed to do so. So I guess, you know, it'd be, it's certainly going to, make it easier, for you to, transition your business. And we think it would be in your best interest to do so since these are very unique loans and that they'll be forgivable, that any assets from those loans that you still have on your balance sheet that are either being used for working capital or just cash reserves, would be eligible to be distributed to the seller in that situation, and thus there's a pretty strong incentive for people who carrying PPP loans on their balance sheet to have them forgiven prior to a transaction. As far as EIDL loans go, you know, EIDL loans are an interesting deal. As of June 15th, the EIDL loan program opened back up with the SBA, and because of the demand for the program, it was my understanding that for most small businesses, not all, but most, they limited the loan amount to $150,000. They went through a new application process, different than PPP. It was not, it didn't go through the banks. It went through a direct to the SBA loan process and a direct evaluation of your eligibility. as well as a distribution of the funds. From clients that have applied for those loans post June 15th, that many of them have been approved and funded within 5 to 7 business days. So they're moving very, very quickly. They have a 30-year amortization with a very low interest rate. So certainly for those of you in the audience that are considering, you know, needing a little extra cash reserves or are looking to refinance some debt, which certainly there's some opportunity to do that, and the eligible use of proceeds, which are to make sure a call to everyone's attention that you look closely at what those eligible use of proceeds are, because there's some disallowed use of proceeds that you need to be somewhat careful of, that, you know, certainly you're going to find a very favorable loan terms and a very easy application and fast process that should be able to be generated. So, Brian, did I answer kind of the general questions about the PPP and EIDL process at this point?
No, sure. I'm just curious, who's the best target for someone to be looking at a loan today? Small business, big, kind of, who's ideal to take on a loan of this in today's environment?
Well, I think, you know, it comes back to, you know, someone who needs it, right? So certainly, if you're in a position where your business has been harmed by COVID, or you're in a position to need to restructure some debt that'll take some pressure off your cash flow, you know, these programs, I mean, all small business loan programs are designed for small business. They're not really designed for medium and large business. So, you know, medium-sized and large businesses have other options for financing other than government-subsidized programs. And I would, you know, recommend everybody look at how they can, you know, if there's a need to smooth out cash flow or to keep their business operating or to use it maybe for hiring. We've certainly seen a huge surge in new business demand by our clients in the IT services space through June. We've almost talked to no one who said that their businesses are down in June. Most of IT services companies are signing new contracts and growing their business, and most of the demand that was that you know, the softness in demand that many of our clients saw, or folks in our network who are IT services saw in late March and April, or maybe even flowing into May, seems to have sort of flowed into June as a pretty dramatic increase in demand. And so, you know, in response to that, you may have a situation where maybe you need to do new hiring, maybe you need to spend ahead a little bit to take advantage of that, you know, we might call a bulge in the pipeline or a bulge in demand. And, you know, these loans certainly could support that as well.
Sure. Now, what do you think about using any of these loans for acquisitive purposes? Or an acquisition of another firm?
Yeah, you know, it's possible. I think the challenge is if the EIDL loans are being capped at $150,000 because of demand, they're not going to be of material value. They may be able to be used as part of a down payment, but that certainly would be needed to be cleared with your banker. You know, and when we look at, you know, many small businesses, IT services companies do use SBA 7A loan programs, which are different than the EIDL loans and PPP loans, to support acquisitions. And in those situations, you know, we recommend that that you contact an SBA preferred lender. And usually you can find SBA preferred lenders versus just SBA lenders on the bankrate.com website. So if you poke around, it's not real easy to find, but if you look at bank ratings, and then you do some searching around the search box on the Bankrate website, you can find a listing of those SBA lenders and the SBA lenders that are considered preferred. The advantage of using an SBA preferred lender versus just an SBA lender is that an SBA preferred lender can make a decision to lend you money under the SBA 7A loan program or other loan programs with their own loan committee. And this is different from just a standard SBA lender who has to send their loan packages to a processing center, an SBA processing center. And it's quite a, it can be quite a lengthy process, one that's filled with a lot of declines or some denials. At least that's been the way it is in the past. Now, I know that the SBA has been working hard to improve their efficiency and the efficacy of getting loans in support of growing small business. And so I believe this is a work in progress by them, and this, these types of recommendations may be less material as time goes on. But as of today, we still think it's the best position is to use an SBA preferred lender in your local community, and to make sure that when you approach them, that you first discuss the concept in general, and this hopefully should be a banker that knows you before you would start on an acquisitive path, and get their feeling for, you know, the bank's appetite for supporting an acquisition with your business. And then, you know, as you get and begin a buy-side initiative to acquire a company, as you get to a signed letter of intent, which you will need to have in order to begin a financing application, essentially with your bank and with the SBA, that you, you know, you're in a position to move forward with that. You should know that it's going to take most banks 6 to 8 weeks to get through the financing process, sometimes a little longer. They need to call out an outside valuation of that business separate from, for example, if you're using us or another broker to facilitate your buy-side activities, we would certainly be doing a valuation in support of your deal, but they're going to need a separate and independent certified valuation. That's a requirement by the SBA, and usually that adds some time. Usually adds 4 to 6 weeks. Doesn't mean that you have to have a linear process. However, you certainly can continue through your due diligence and be working through your financing at the same time, and then, you know, working with the outside evaluator as you're moving towards a close.
Sure. And how would you compare this to using perhaps some friends and family or even private equity funds and to get a deal done? They certainly have some different merits in what private equity might bring to the table, but how would you value a loan versus a more intensive funding effort?
Well, it, you know, it's my opinion that that equity is always a really expensive way to raise money, and that you have to understand, you know, private equity firms make investments in small companies because for the ones that are successful, it's a real profitable venture for them. And I think, you know, the best way to think about it is, you know, if you raise some money through private equity and you go and, you know, you increase the value of your firm by 10 times over the next, you know, let's say 5 years, you're giving up, in an average private equity deal, you might be giving up half of that value to the private equity firm, right? And that's significant versus, you know, currently debt financing is reasonably easy to get. It's inexpensive. You would be paying just interest, if you will, on that money. And if you did the same thing, if you went and built out, you know, increased the value of your firm by 10x, you most likely would have the majority of that debt financing paid for, or a big significant portion of it paid for by the time you may want to do a transaction to sell your own business. You would get the benefit of all that appreciation. So, pretty important to think about that and make sure that you have clarity because the cost of that capital is significantly higher in private equity than it is otherwise.
Sure. And going along that line, should a company be looking for loans or equity if they have a very strong cash position?
Well, certainly if you have a strong cash position, I mean, even if you look for a loan, like an SBA loan, you got to have 20% down. So, you know, it's not like they're going to give you 100% loan, of the value you need to do that acquisition. And so, you know, you're going to need some cash, right? You don't need a ton, but you're going to need, you know, most likely 20% of a good rule of thumb of that purchase price. Certainly there's deal structuring, unique deal structuring options that you can implement, vis-a-vis, you know, either pay-as-you-go models or seller financing or some combination of those things, earnouts, that would reduce that amount of down payment because you're just not going to borrow as much money from the bank. If you've got cash on the balance sheet, certainly we think that that is a good use of capital, to do acquisitions. We know that, generally, you know, in a build versus buy analysis, you can get there faster by acquiring than building. not to say that one way, you know, that you shouldn't be doing, having a strong organic strategy, as you, you know, work on building out, the business. You certainly need that, especially to help guide your, acquisitive strategy. But, you know, at the end of the day, you're going to get a bigger return, I think, if you deploy that capital, in an acquisition than you may, organically. But yeah, you know, if you can afford a deal for cash, certainly, you know, don't hesitate to do that. Some combination of cash or seller financing or, you know, non-bank financing, if you can do it, certainly is something you should strongly consider. Whether that money comes from friends or family or not, sometimes, you know, friends and family money can be preferable depending on the terms, right? I think the SBA certainly is very inexpensive money, particularly for those that might have had a significant amount of equity either in any of their assets or in the business itself. You have to remember that you have to collateralize a SBA loan. The SBA does accept under collateralization, and then that's government backed. So I guess it just would depend on the terms of any outside friends and family financing, how you might collateralize a loan with friends and family. Might not require collateralization, may just be what we call signature loan. And certainly that would be, you know, fine as well. But I think if you had cash on the balance sheet, certainly that's always preferable to borrowing money because it's less expensive.
Sure, sure. And just to revisit the topic, we may have talked about it a little bit before, but how should a seller treat a PPP loan if they're going through an acquisition process? And conversely, what does a buyer need to look at when evaluating a company that has this new potential influx of capital and with a loan forgiveness? It's a really unique situation that we're going through. So how does that play into valuations and the closing transactions within a deal if a company has received some PPP loans?
Well, you know, I think most transactions require that you settle the debt, right? It's sort of this debt-free approach. Some are cash-free and debt-free, meaning you can harvest your cash and you know, you have to settle your debt. Some are, you have to have a working capital ratio type approach in the business, but certainly you still have to settle your debt. So if a PPP loan is still owed, you're going to have to settle it. That's why, as I mentioned earlier, it would be in your benefit as a seller to get that forgiven, because one way or another, you got to pay it, right? You're either going to have to pay it back, or you're going to have to get it forgiven. And, it'll be, I suspect, pretty challenging to get that loan transferred, to a new buyer. Sometimes that can occur and you can get banks to agree to that. But I would tell you that, or even buyers to agree to assume your debt as part of the purchase price. But often, it's required that that debt gets sort of, you know, cleared up, if you will. And because of that, I think, you know, you're going to want to get that tied out one way or another. Now, if it were for me, I certainly would rather have the government forgive the lion's share, if not all of that loan, versus having to pay it back, because it's in some ways, you can think of it as free money. It's going to need to get resolved one way or another. Even if you exhausted the cash that came from that loan, it's either got to get forgiven or paid back to actually do the transaction. And that would be the case for any debt in order for you to transfer the assets of the business without any encumbrances. Whether they're buying the stock or as a stock deal or an asset deal, the business has to come over without any encumbrances. And that means that all that debt, or anything that would have attached the assets of the business, including bank lines and even if lines of credit are not being used, you know, need to be either closed or resolved or paid. And usually that happens either from the proceeds of the transaction or via another way prior to a transaction.
Sure. Now, you mentioned something about working capital and working capital ratios. And can you explain just a bit of why it's important to keep certain working capital ratios? And does the PPP loan and PPP loan forgiveness, will that have a potential of having an influx of cash and perhaps changing those working capital ratios that you might peg to a within in a transaction?
Yeah, so I would say that most buyers want to get an average working capital number, like let's say an annual average working capital number left in the business as you transact a deal. And if you're a seller, that may be fine depending on how much working capital you leave in the business. But I would tell you that most sellers overcapitalize their businesses so they don't have to be getting in and out of their bank lines, and because they, you know, may want to just have excess cash sitting around so that if they can, you know, very proactively manage their accounts payable. And so, you know, at a minimum, oftentimes they have more than 30 days of extra cash sitting on the balance sheet that may not be required for the buyer to operate the business. So as far as working capital goes, a buyer is going to want to look at a probably either a 6 month or 1 year working capital average. And because of those working capital averages, they're going to ask for all that average working capital that you've had on the balance sheet. Now, most small business owners, in particular in IT services, keep at least an extra 30 days of working capital on the balance sheet, so they're not in and out of their credit facilities, and that, you know, they have the ability to, more proactively manage their AP so it doesn't get old or get over 30 days. The challenge with some of that in the context of an M&A deal is that if a buyer more traditionally looks for average net working capital, then they're going to want to take that over capitalization in the transaction as part of the deal, saying that, well, you wouldn't have carried it on the balance sheet. The argument is you wouldn't have carried it on the balance sheet if you didn't need it, which isn't entirely true. And so we think it's better to look at a coverage ratio to payables, right, and to be able to transfer the business with a particular coverage ratio that's determined to be applicable. It's just a little different way to look at it. Like, for example, if you were to have a coverage ratio of 2, a 2-to-1 coverage ratio, you would have twice as much current asset as you would a current liability on an average basis. And, you know, you could argue, and some sellers argue this, that you really would only need to have about a coverage ratio 1 or 1-to-1. So that, you know, current assets equals current liabilities. Now, the truth is actually somewhere in the middle, because you do have to account for bad debt, and you do have to account for slow pay, and you do have to look at DSO, days sales outstanding, to determine how quickly people pay to get to the real number. But this whole concept, and it's part of why you probably need to have your accountant or an M&A advisor in the middle of the deal so that we could, or your accountant can, you know, determine the right amount of working capital along with the buyer and make sure you don't leave extra working capital on the balance sheet during a transaction. It's our opinion that, this gets somewhat exacerbated by PPP because if, for example, you're carrying extra cash on the balance sheet because you've gotten an allocation from the PPP loan process, you ultimately then now have more working capital, maybe you have a ratio, coverage ratio 4-to-1 or 5-to-1 or 6-to-1 that you may not need. And if you begin to look at the yearly average sort of model, which has traditionally been used by, you know, everybody from private equity firms to other acquirers, you suddenly now have quite a bit of what we'll consider extra, significantly an extra amount of working capital that a buyer could request. And we think then going back to our original recommendation of a working capital ratio kind of conversation about what's actually required to pay payables, assuming you have appropriate payroll accruals on your payables ledger, is the right way to go. And hopefully that's clear, Ryan.
Yeah, it makes a ton of sense. And it's a bit of an interesting conundrum that we have seen. I mean, in every deal we get to, working capital is always a large negotiation part. And it's understandable. Any cash that's left there that the seller essentially can harvest, and that becomes a big deal. So it will be interesting to see how this plays out over the next year and as more firms take advantage and use some of these PPP loans and potential forgiveness. Switching gears a little bit, part of another question that we're getting in nearly every deal is buyers really want to get a new forecast of the seller's business. And it's always couched in the terms of, you know, how are you doing in COVID and what's the future of COVID? What advice can you give to buyers looking at sellers and vice versa? What should sellers, how should they be forecasting in terms when there's so much uncertainty in the air?
Yep. You know, I would say that, you know, forecasting is always tricky, right? Because you're looking at a situation where, you know, you're trying to predict the future. And I think that, you know, the only thing we know for certain about most forecasts or financial projections is, you know, they're not going to be exactly 100% on. So there is some amount of variability in those forecasts. Now, I think when you're thinking about a forecast kind of in a post-COVID world, you know, everything ultimately in the stock market and the business and all that stuff tends to move back towards the midline, right? Tends to move back towards stasis or the trend line over time. And so it's critical to be able to think about that in the context of, you know, how did your business perform over the last 12 or 24 or 36 months or much more longer trend view of the business since post-COVID. You can't expect the performance on a go-forward basis to be all that different than it had been on the sort of long-tail past. And so I think you have to look at every situation as a little bit different, and that you need to be able to make some sense of, you know, what it is to do this. And I think the reason why buyers ask for forecasts is because they're trying to generally get a feel for the health and wellness of the business on a go-forward basis. And you're the closest person to that business, right? You're the closest person. It's going to be a guess by anybody, but you have the most educated guess, so to speak. And so I think it's critically important that you look at it and say, this is something that this is our best estimate, and this is where we think it will be based on what we have for pipeline. I would caution you to not overcall the forecast due to near-term pipeline activity, because based on our experience, everybody's seeing a bit of a bulge in their pipeline, right? They saw numbers kind of go down or pull back in the kind of April, May timeline. They've seen a pretty big surge back in June. And that is easy to get, convince yourself that, well, that, you know, demand is going to continue into the next, you know, 12 to 24 months. Might not be the case, right? I think it's more important to be a little bit more scientific about your forecasting methodology. And there's plenty of them. I mean, you can find forecasting models all over the internet and, you know, allow you to look at your history and look at the future. I think it's critically important for most businesses to continue to, and we've done many podcasts around this, you know, market and sell aggressively in this time. Why things may be coming out of a bit of a, you know, lull in the end of March and April and May. And in the end, you know, try to do, give a best guess, best estimate view of your forecast. and use history as a guide.
Sure. That makes sense. Mike, that's kind of the questions I've got here for today. Appreciate it today. Next week, I think we can pick up some similar topics. But we're heading into the fourth. Anything special that firms should be thinking about or anything different that you've seen? I can relate that we have certainly seen people ready for a holiday, but we traditionally have seen a large pickup in business in traction and getting a hold of people and having great conversations in July. Any predictions for this next month?
Yeah, you know, I'm very bullish on July, August, and September, and moving into the fall quarter of this year about what we're going to see in our industry in IT services. I, you know, our company is a bit of a bellwether for what's happening in the industry. And typically in the summer, we see here at Revenue Rocket a couple months of what we would call slowness, you know, pipeline slowness or things slowing down, predominantly because of people taking vacations and holiday. And we can't always predict what months those would be. Sometimes they're May and June, sometimes they're June and July, sometimes they're July and August, sometimes August, September. Over the years, it's been always 2 months, and it's always been sometime in the summer. I think, frankly, that's kind of been pushed back to the COVID time. And, you know, in our business, we certainly see in the conversations that we're having with IT services companies a lot of optimism and a lot of actual orders coming through in June. Most pipelines are exceptionally strong for July and August. And we certainly see M&A deals happening. We've got, you know, lots of deals that are closing and lots of new letters of intent that are getting signed. So there's a lot of M&A optimism, but there's a lot of general business optimism that we're seeing in IT services as well. And I think, you know, as we continue to move towards the end of the year, I would expect us to have a very, very good H2, as we'll call it, the second half of the year versus the first half of the year, with most of the bad news concentrated into the second quarter. Many of our clients had a very strong Q1. Q2, of course, was disrupted because of COVID, and now they're, you know, gearing up for a very strong second half.
Great. Well, I appreciate the insight, and let's hope that that stays true.
Yep. Sounds good, Ryan. Tying a ribbon on it. It was excellent. Thanks for the conversation. We look forward to talking to all of you again very soon on next week's podcast.